How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, we have you covered. For a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. As a listener of DNA Today, you've heard me interview countless guests about genetic testing. I'm sure you've thought to yourself, I wonder what my results would be. Now you can find out or gift it to someone else for the holidays. At Panacea, you can access affordable whole exome sequencing. That's analyzing all of your coding genes, genetic counseling, and physician oversight in a 10-minute workflow for under $1,000. As a DNA Today listener, you get 30% off. That's a $300 discount. Just use code DNA Today at seekpanacea.com. Again, that's code DNA Today at seekpanacea.com for $300 off your kit. The link is also in the show notes. Joining me now is Nika Smith, pro genealogist with over 20 years of experience. She's the host of Black Pro Gen Live, a web series focused on genealogy and family history with a special focus on people of color. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So my first question for you is why you think people are so drawn towards ancestry? Because you get anybody talking about it, they're interested to some degree. Unlike any other topic you throw at someone, it's like, oh, maybe it sticks, maybe it doesn't. But people just have this innate curiosity towards their ancestry. Why?
Well, it's one of the things in life we have no control over. You know, you know what I mean? Like, we absolutely have no control over. Like, we can control, you know, I mean, obviously through things like the rhythm method and contraceptives, whether or not we have children. We can control where we live. We can control, you know, for the most part, the job we have and things like that. Like, a lot of these things are choices, but our family, you know, the people that create us, that's not something that we can create. That's not something we can orchestrate. Now, granted, there are plenty of opportunities that people have throughout life to create community and family on their own. You know, especially if they don't necessarily align with their biological family ideology, you know, with their ideologies or maybe in their lifestyle choices and things like that. But, you know, but at the bare bones, you know, the biology of everything, we have no control over who our family members are and who our ancestors are. And so I think that's what makes family history research and ancestry so alluring. Is that it's this kind of excavation journey. It's a scavenger hunt, you know, and some people do not like scavenger hunts. They just want to get to the end. They want to see the pot at the end of, you know, of the rainbow, you know, and to kind of liken it to like some of our like cultural stuff, you know, there were certain kids that like Lucky Charms, the entire cereal, right? Like they ate everything. They yes. ate the marshmallows. They ate the, you know, I don't even know what the other part of the cereal is called because as a kid, I ate the marshmallows out. I didn't eat.
The more grainy part, I guess.
Right.
I don't even know a great explanation, but
I don't even know what it's called.
Marshmallow part.
Right. But I would, because you have to think about the level of scavenging you have to do as a kid to pick the marshmallows out to eat them. So it really kind of aligns, I think, to this conversation we're having around the you know, the alluring parts of tracing our family history and ancestry. It's you know, we're picking out the marshmallows. And some people will only pick the ones that have certain colors. Some people will pick all of them. Some people will eat the entire thing. Some people don't even want to be bothered with the cereal at all because they eat something completely different. Maybe they like oatmeal. But we have to respect everyone's journey to get to this information. And usually the average person is interested. Their interest is peaked at some point in their lives.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think even just in my own family of people doing some ancestry research through different records, and we'll get into some of this as well as we go, but everybody's interested to a certain degree. And some people are like, all right, this is where I tap out. Like, now we're getting a little bit too into this. But these are for the people that are super into it. So obviously it's very interesting. But can it also be valuable, useful information?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, to me, I often joke like, that ever I can connect anything in the world to genealogy and family history. It does not matter. I mean, I literally just gave an example about Lucky Charm cereal. Now, when's the last time I ate
You've
that?
Already proven you have that skill set.
Right. I'm like, when's the last time I like, seriously, like I literally can connect it to anything, you know, to be timely like this week with this announcement. If people watch sports and they're keeping track of like college football and Deion Sanders going from Jackson State to Colorado. Right. I even connected that. I was talking to people. They're like, well, what do you mean? There is a connection. Historically, Black colleges and universities, they start because of segregation and who had the opportunity to go and play. And then how you have him, who's Deion Sanders. Historically, let's talk about him. He played two sports. People don't even do that anymore. He played baseball and he played football. And how his life journey is that. But now it's going into playing in Colorado, which traditionally you don't necessarily have a lot of Black people there, but you do because of people moving out of the Deep South and exploring the country and trying to go for better opportunities. So you literally see how many touch points I just touched on with just Deion Sanders. All of these things connect back to history and genealogy. Like they just do. And we're living genealogy, we're living family history every day. We leave little nuggets and pieces behind that other people are going to come up, either our descendants, direct descendants or family members are going to want to come and do research. They're going to want to know, how in the world did the two of these people get together? Like, how are they on this podcast together? Like, how did they find each other? Right? Like all of that is genealogy, all of it is family history. And that's really what we're charged to do when we begin this journey, is to try to figure out, well, how did these two people get together, right? That's literally all it is, only instead of it being, you know, 2022, it's 1945, or it's, you know, 1782.
And we can't talk about ancestry without bringing up genetic testing, obviously, right? You guys knew that was coming. So when we look at ancestry testing, we often are looking at the big companies, 23andMe, Ancestry DNA, MyHeritage. Why does the ancestry percentage change over time in these portals? So I know for one of my relatives, you know, they're like, wow, we're 1% Asian. And I knew, I probably know kind of where you're, how you're going to answer this, but eventually that disappeared. So it didn't change. We didn't suddenly become that, you know, we're no longer 1% Asian. But can you explain like how our genetic results can change over time?
Absolutely. So genetic results are not always static. In fact, you actually kind of don't want them to be. The reason why is as the technology gets better, as the algorithm of the test that you've taken gets better, it's going to shift, you know? So I've seen people go out and get tattoos of their admixture on their arms. And I'm like, oh, you might not have wanted to do that.
That's not going
to
age well.
Right. It's not going to age
well. Unless that's a temporary tattoo.
Correct. Correct. But the reason why you don't want it to really stay stagnant is because, again, things are getting better. You know, think about the first cell phone you ever had and the pictures that came out of it. I mean, we thought, yeah, we're rocking. This thing is great. Until the iPhone 13 came out and you're like, oh my gosh, look at what this does in like no light. Yeah,
and now I have
right?
the 14. I mean, how many cameras can we get in one device?
On one phone, right, on one device. Yeah. So literally, if you look at just your phone and pictures, you see over time, stuff has shifted. It's changed. It's gotten more advanced. It has way more features. DNA should also do the same thing. Your admixture should also do the same thing. And tests are based on reference panels. These are things where the companies will get publicly available data sets, include them into their algorithm, as well as kind of analyze the results that come from their actual customers testing to just, you know, define communities better. And these are places all over the world. So it could be that as of when your family member took the test, you know, that segment of DNA was coming, you know, was reading Asian, but then now it may not be that anymore. Maybe it's like, oh, you know what? We need to refine that more. Maybe that should go into another area. So yeah, you know, when you're looking at those trace regions, things that are under like 5%, you got to keep in mind that that stuff is going to shift and change over time. And we want it to, because we want it to be as accurate as possible.
Yeah, that's what I tell patients all the time when they come in. And one of the questions I ask when I go over family health history is, do you have any Ashkenazi Jewish background? Or I say just Jewish ancestry. And people always ask, you know, why are you asking that? And that's kind of a whole another segue. But they're like, yeah, it came up like 2% on my ancestry. And in my head, I'm like, okay, so I don't think that really counts, because if they look back, it's probably going to disappear. And right. That's, as you're saying, it's because our databases are getting better and we're understanding, oh, that little piece of DNA, those little sequences, that actually came from this region and not what we originally thought. So it's not our DNA that's changing, but it's our understanding of how that fits in terms of human ancestry and just evolution. Now, part of that with databases is that databases have a lot of people of European ancestry in the databases, and they don't have as much non-European ancestry or people with more recent lineage to Africa and other areas. So when I do a genetic test, and I've done one through Ancestry DNA, I for my paternal side, my dad's side, I know that from family stories, we're from East Cork, Ireland. And so when I go through with that, it actually does come up. East Cork, Ireland is the majority, and then a little bit Central Cork and whatnot. But that's going to be different if that wasn't my ancestry. It's not going to be as specific from what I've heard from other people of different ancestry than me. Are there certain companies that you think are doing a better job than others, or what you recommend in terms of having a more diverse database? I mean, I don't want to necessarily put you on the spot, I guess, with naming, but I guess any other thoughts with just having our databases be more diverse and inclusive?
Well, part of the challenge with the inclusivity of databases is where people can get samples. That's also one of the things that we have to keep in mind. So if European countries are providing more of a sample size as opposed to certain, you know, African or even Asian locations, then the databases are going to have more predominant European ancestry within them. At the same time, though, you know, we've seen this boon in testing. And so whereas the reference panel may have been initially driven entirely by the, you know, the samples that were publicly available, we're able to sort of recalibrate based on customers who are testing. And one of the ways that you can do that is if you've identified customers who have ancestry where all four grandparents are from the same African country. You can do that same thing in other countries in Asia as well, right? And so with that said, things are getting better and more specific. For instance, each company offers different things, but specifically on Ancestry, one of the things that I think a lot of people miss are the communities. Where the admixture, or what I call your sexy par chart, you know, everyone wants that, right? That's got, you know, Cameroon, Congo, Western Bantu nations, you know, England, Scotland, Senegal, Mali. It's got all of that. That's within the last 2,000 years. But if you scroll down the page, you actually get communities. And the communities are within the last 150 to 200 years. So it's much more recent. And those are diverse as I don't know what. And they're accurate. Some of them even go down to the county. And I'm not even specifically saying, you know, because in Ireland, I have a cousin, I joke, she's the most Black Irish person I've ever seen in my life. And she has, you know, County Cork. She's got all this, you know, those areas that are
so
broken
down. So she's my
down.
Cousin is what you're saying.
Correct. Then, you know? Right. She could totally be related to you. And she's got all of that stuff. But then she also has things like early Virginia African Americans. She's got North Carolina groups. I've got Mississippi and Louisiana African Americans. So even if we're not down to necessarily the tribe level or the chiefdom level in West Africa yet, we still have a more current connection to where our ancestors are stateside, or even in the Caribbean. It's not even just stateside, it's in the Caribbean as well. I was talking to someone last week who one of their parents is Puerto Rican. They had indigenous Puerto Rico. They had several areas in Puerto Rico. So even if you haven't done the work on your tree, you can drill down in communities to get even an idea of like where, you know, even more recently. And, you know, like I always talk about the first time I ever saw that feature, I just could not, like, I was like, how
and
did you do this?
It's somewhat recent because I remember when I first did it, I did it when I was starting grad school for people that have been long time listening. So that was like Christmas of 2018. And so that's when I got one of my friends, shout out Annika, got that for me. And so I did it. And then I feel like later that's when it popped up, because for me, there's people from Ohio, New York, you know, mm-hmm. That's kind of different sides of the family there. But yeah, I'm like, how are they able to do that with such recent ancestry? I mean, yeah, you're talking about like a few generations back.
It really,
like, that's like my great grandmother. That's not
correct.
Even that far.
It's, And it is accurate. Like,
It matches all the family stories. I'm like,
it matches everything. Right. Like, and I really honestly feel like it's one of the most overlooked aspects of the current landscape of genetic testing. You know, I mean, I've tested with 23andMe, and even with 23andMe, there's also they attempt to break out certain regions a little bit, but it's based off of your matches and them having ancestors that people have self-identified as being from certain locations.
Which that's going to be different than we looked at the genetics, and this is what
correct. And so, you know, with that one, I have a cousin where, because he was born in, where was he born? In Trinidad. It said, oh, well, you've got ancestry in Trinidad. But when I traced this cousin's tree, his people were Jamaican. They moved to Trinidad. Right. That's the only reason why he was born there. So,
right. It's not like retroactively. It's like, no, his parents moved there and had him there. Yeah.
Right. Right. But you have to, again, with all of the technology, it's going to shift and change because we have to control for things like this. We have to control for migration and movement of people. You know, if you do any amount of research in the Caribbean, you know, those folks didn't always stay in the same place. They moved around where they had opportunity and work and things like that. And it's the same way in a bunch of other spots as well.
The holiday season is upon us, which means we are all racking our brains trying to think of the perfect gift idea. Why not give the gift of health information? At Panacea, you can access affordable whole exome sequencing. That's analyzing all of your coding genes, genetic counseling, and physician oversight in a 10-minute workflow for under $1,000. This is astounding when you compare that to the average whole exome sequencing price of $8,800 just last year in 2021. By knowing your hereditary risk for diseases like cancer and cardiovascular disease, you and your doctors can create a targeted approach to help catch the disease before it becomes a problem. Their launch is starting with the residents of Florida. So if you live in another state or a different country, you can sign up on their website to be notified when testing is available in your area. As a DNA Today listener, you get 30% off. That's a $300 discount. Just use code DNA Today at seekpanacea.com. Again, that's code DNA Today at seekpanacea.com for $300 off. And to make it easy, the link's in the show notes. Make preventative healthcare reality with Panacea. So let's kick it up a notch. I want to ask some questions that I don't know the answers to, which is always really fun.
I'm like, so how do you know I know these things?
Oh, because you're an expert, Nika. Come on. So I know the basic concept here. But to explore maternal versus paternal specific lineage, it's helpful on the maternal side to look at mitochondrial DNA, because that we're getting from, you know, and I'm going to be using mom, dad in terms of kind of binary terms here. But, you know, I'm have an asterisk with everything I say here. So you got the mitochondrial DNA from the maternal lineage, and then looking at the Y chromosome is helpful for the paternal lineage. So are there any kind of companies that you can name or ways that people can actually do this testing? Because people have like DM'd me asking this and I'm like, I don't know. I'm not an expert in ancestry. I'm going to have to bring Nika on the show. So like how do you go about doing this? Because this is an extra level than me just spitting and sending it off to Ancestry DNA or 23andMe. This is a little bit different.
Right, right. So for the mitochondrial testing and even the Y chromosomal testing, people need to be clear that these are direct line tests. What I mean by that is, as someone who identifies as a woman, you know, who was born female, I've got two X chromosomes. One of them comes from my mother. So if I do a mitochondrial test, it's going to trace me, my mom, her mother, her mother, her mother, her mother, mom's mom's mom, going all the way straight back. Now, because I was born female, I can thus not test for Y chromosome. Okay. So that means that I would have to test my father, or I'd have to test my brother or my nephew through my brother, because all of those men share the same Y chromosome coming from the same man. So if they take the Y chromosome test, it's going to test their father's 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 line. Now, there are not a lot of companies that do testing for mitochondrial DNA and for Y DNA. Family Tree DNA is one of the companies that does offer that testing, as well as African Ancestry. But they're really kind of doing two different things. African Ancestry is testing connections to African countries. And if you have ancestors on those direct lines that go back to Europe, they'll say, they go back to Europe. Family Tree DNA is doing they're identifying the haplogroup, and they're also matching you against the other people in their database that come from that same woman, based on a series of markers. And so you do get aspects of mitochondrial and Y-DNA testing through a company like 23andMe. They will give you your haplogroup, you know, so I can get my maternal haplogroup, you know, my brother or my nephews could get my father's paternal haplogroup. And I've actually learned how to work around, because what if you don't have people alive to do this testing? And,
yeah,
you know, again,
that's a big factor.
Right, right. And, you know, I was born female, so that Y is not coming to me. So,
nope, we're not going to find a Y in you. If we did, right, then something's going on. Bone marrow transplant, something.
Right, right. I'm a Shimra. Right. It's going
to
be.
Yes. Right, yeah, right. Another... Ooh, then I'd have to have you back on the show, do a whole thing on that.
Right. So it would have to be something like that. But for certain lines of my family, I've, you know, done the genealogy work to figure out who the direct descendants are of certain people to be able to do those Y chromosome tests or even do mitochondrial. For me, you know, with my direct female line, it's been very interesting because, you know, I'm L3B and I actually have DNA matches from the autosomal perspective, again, from the autosomes, from the numbered chromosomes 1 to 22. I've got DNA matches on that specific side that I know the exact area and the state and the town and the village in Nigeria on.
Wow. So it can get very specific if you're using the right data sets.
Correct. So it's a couple of things, right? Like I know my direct maternal line is L3B. It goes, you know, to West Africa, but through admixture testing and DNA, you know, and really it wasn't even because I carried the segment. It was because my grandmother and one of her great, great nieces did. Mm. We've got about 130 people tested on my maternal grandmother's side of the family. So when someone new pops up and it's not a name that we don't recognize, it's a name we don't recognize. We're like, who's that? Right. Like we're just, you know, like we ask the question, like, wait a minute, I don't know who you are, you know, and not like
your family tree. You've tested that many people. I mean,
we have that.
Wild.
Yeah. And literally, I don't think I've bought a kit for any of those people at all. They've all done it on their own. And I think this also, it goes to say, when you share the information that you are finding in your family history journey, people are going to want to help. They're going to want to learn more. They're going to want to absorb it themselves and see it for themselves. And on this particular branch of my family, once I said, hey, you know, this testing is helping us identify new family members and all of that, people jumped right in. I didn't even have to ask. And so with that said, we can figure out very easily which sides people factor in on because we have so many people tested. And these are all descendants of my grandmother's great-grandparents. That's how, and her grandparents were enslaved. All of my grandmother's grandparents were enslaved. All of them were. So the fact that we have, again, it's probably the earliest sort of DNA project that I ever had. It's totally informed other things that I've done. You know, one of the largest projects that I'm over, close to 8,000 people have identified that are connected to one plantation, a set of plantations in, you know, between Louisiana and Mississippi. And the only way I found out about it was because of DNA. That was it. I would have never found it on paper.
Yeah, because how would we, with people of formerly enslaved ancestors, there's going to not be as much documents as other people will have. And you have an awesome YouTube video on this. We're going to link to it in the show notes. But could you share with us a little bit about how people can begin to track down their formerly enslaved ancestors and what records you recommend for people to seek? Because you've done this for your own family and helped other people and other families.
Right. And I think one of the biggest thought processes that people have is that they just weren't documented, right? Like at all. It's and when you think about the fact that this was a system that was really driven on money, these were individuals who were walking around and they were literally money on two legs. So when you think about it from that vantage point, which, I mean, you have to sort of detach yourself emotionally from the fact that people themselves were monetized, not their work, not, you know, that people were monetized, then you think about it from the different vantage point. how could I have documented that money on paper or that person on paper? Because that's my wealth. So to add to that, I think of the example I just gave with the 8,000. I knew my family going back to a certain period, but I kept finding all these matches from this county just across the state line. And it wasn't making sense. Like, what? We don't have anybody that was there. So how do I have, like, literally 30 people? That's not three. That's not five. That's 30 people. This is almost like the ancestors setting up a neon sign and flashing it at you. Like, look. It's right
here.
Over here.
Stop ignoring me.
Right. And so one of the easiest things that people can do is look at the community their ancestors are in, especially if they were there prior to the Great Migration, meaning prior to early 1900s, really the 1950s or so, when folks were moving around. Look at the community that they're in. Who are the other African-American families that are there? Have you traced your ancestors as far back as you can get them? Have you gotten them to 1870 and 1880? Who is in community with them? Because with this group of 8,000, that's how I found the connection to slavery, was because they were all living around each other in 1870, 1880, 1900, 1910, 1920, 1930, 1940, 1950. They are all still living around each other now. But if you do things like look for the nearest white person, because that's something that folks have taught for years, like, oh, look for the nearest white person that has a lot of money in 1870. That's not foolproof, because there were a lot of folks who came down from the Northeast because we had a huge amount of land that and agriculture that could have failed. Our country really could have been in ruin, that they came down and leased. Those people may not even have owned enslaved people. But those enslaved, formerly enslaved people, they likely were there before the war, and they can give you clues. And so I would say, definitely trace back as far as you can. You can use resources like the Freedmen's Bureau, which is an incredible record set that is totally understudied and underutilized, where you have, it only was really in operation for like 8 years, but it's the federal government coming in to stabilize the country and, you know, doing things like providing rations, schooling, marrying people, facilitating labor contracts between former slave owners and the formerly enslaved, certain aspects of the United States colored troops they were over, all of that stuff. It's the first time you can see people documented as people and not with dollar values across from their name as property. So you have that, you've got probates and or successions where slaveholders died before 1865, they'll have an inventory of property, and that will include things like beds and carriages and wagons along with people. You also have things like, mortgages or even land transactions. A lot of people will come across those documents and think, oh, no one cares about 7% interest and this payment, not reading down to the bottom. Well, how did they secure that loan? Sometimes it's with people. So you will see, in consideration for the terms of this loan, so-and-so puts up the following Negro men and women slaves. And don't corral slavery to just being a Southern thing, because slavery was legal across the entire country. You had people going out to California during the gold rush, bringing slaves and knowing that slavery was not legal and that they had 365 days to keep that enslaved person in California. And on the 364th, they could take them out and restart the clock. People did that.
Wow.
There's gradual emancipation in the northern states, right? Oh, hey, slavery's over, but you got to stay enslaved until you're 21. That happened in the north. Then you have free people of color, individuals who were never enslaved, who typically lived in enclaves together to protect themselves. You had fugitive enslaved people. You know, folks just think it was very black and white, and it wasn't. And when we encounter these gray things, we don't understand how people lived them, but we live in gray stuff now. And people later are not going to understand how we lived in gray stuff. So yeah, so besides Freedmen's Bureau, 1870, 1880 census, successions or probates, land records, land transactions, if you go back to that 8,000, that's one of the reasons why I have people documented, enslaved people documented 15 times, is because their slaveholders were mortgaging against them yearly. So that list of 250 people every year, because they're there as the collateral, it is serving as a census for me. That's exactly how I use it.
I never would have thought to look at that. That's brilliant.
People don't even, I mean, this is how you learn, right? Is, you know, I love a good rabbit hole. Like, I have to have one every once in a while. You know, you got to learn yourself, right?
Oh, like, there's just nothing better than that. You look at the clock, you're like, oh, I got to go to bed.
Right. And for me, it's replicating me picking out the marshmallows from the Lucky Charm cereal. That's what the rabbit hole is for me. And so, yes, look at those transactions. You know, the 8,000, their initial slaveholder lived in the North. He spent his year between Massachusetts and Mississippi. And if you look at his estate stuff in the North, oh, they've got pews to the church he paid for. And oh, look at this $130,000 debt to his brother has with him. On paper, just looks like a debt. But if you don't delve into what that was for, which was a plantation and slaves, you would be none the wiser. So yeah, check out those deeds, mortgages, conveyance records, universities. I think a lot of people don't realize that colleges and universities have incredible records that are from enslaving families, diaries, ledgers, all of that kind of stuff. You know, thankfully we've had some incredible academics that have gone through colleges and universities and microfilmed and, you know, those collections and put them together in something that people can use and can access from home, you know, but there's still a lot of digitization that has to happen. So there are some places where you actually have to go there to see it. Historical societies, the same thing. Even your local courthouse, people don't even realize that this is for you. Your tax dollars are paying to keep these records. And if you are in a place where slavery happened, and they have those records, you can walk into that courthouse and pull out a book and find them.
And isn't that more exciting to like be in person and finding it rather than sitting on your computer? Yeah, you know, I said that as we're sitting on a computer talking about this. But, you know, there's something like, you know, the adventure to it, I feel like, of uncovering your ancestry and all that. And my goodness, I mean, you just have so many good tips and everything. We're going to link to multiple of your YouTube videos that I've enjoyed in the show notes for people to enjoy on there. But thank you so much, Nika, for coming on. I mean, it's just, you're so fantastic and so engaging. And I just really want to thank you for educating myself and my listeners.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnapodcast.com, where you can also stream all episodes of the show. We encourage your questions, comments, guest pitches, and ideas. Send them all into info@dnapodcast.com. Search DNA Today on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, so you can connect with us there. And a favor, please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. DNA Today is hosted and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our social media lead is Corinne Merlino. Our video lead is Amanda Andrioli. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.